Congress passed the first farm bill back in the Depression to give financial help to struggling farmers. A succession of farm bills since then have been a major component of federal agriculture policy, covering everything from crop price supports to food safety. But the nation doesn't have a farm bill right now. A deadlocked Congress let the old farm bill expire without passing a new one due to disagreements over budget cutting and food aid programs like SNAP. There are consequences if Congress fails to pass a farm bill, both immediate and long term. I'm Jim Meadows. Today on Focus, we'll take a look at the farm bill, what it covers, and what could happen without one. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Congressional negotiators working on a new federal farm bill say they made progress yesterday, but they are not promising that the bill can be passed by January 1st. That means either a stopgap measure must be approved to extend some provisions of the bill, or some food prices, notably dairy, could start to rise sharply. Now, those are the sort of details you might hear about the farm bill in a regular newscast. But really, do you understand what it's all about? I confess I don't, except that the farm bill is a huge part of this country's agriculture policy. It touches on everything from price supports for crops to food safety to food assistance programs such as SNAP, also known as food stamps. Negotiations on this newest multi-year farm bill have not gone smoothly. There's been sharp partisan disagreement on a bill that was once seen as largely nonpartisan, at least in the larger sense of congressional debate. Well, to explain the farm bill to us on Focus today, I'm welcoming two guests. And with me here in the studio is Jonathan Coppice. He is clinical professor of law and policy in the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And Jonathan has a background in government agricultural policy that includes working fairly recently on the current farm bill for the Senate Ag Committee. Professor Coppice, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
And welcome also on the phone, Mary Kay Thatcher. She's coming to us from Washington. She is Senior Director of Congressional Affairs for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Plus, she manages a farm out in Iowa. Ms. Thatcher, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
And I guess the first question here is because some people are starting to say scary things on what might happen if a farm bill doesn't get passed by some time or another. If Congress is continued to be deadlocked on a new farm bill, what could happen in this country, Mary Kay, and when would it happen?
Well, certainly the farm bill actually expired on the 30th of September, and I think there's been very little indication. There have been a few implications, but for the most part that goes unnoticed. And that's exactly where we were a year ago in 2012. As Jonathan can tell you, he spent night and day working on that in the Senate Ag Committee, and it's been almost 3 years now that it's been ongoing, so we're all ready to get it done. But I don't think there's anything magical about that September 30th date, nor do I think there's anything magical about not getting it done by January 1st. Certainly you read in the press about, well, we might have $7 a gallon milk, and that will have to happen if we cannot finish this farm bill or, in the end, some kind of extension isn't going to happen. But the fact is that there's nothing magic about January 1st. And so while we certainly hope we can deal with this before Congress goes home, if it takes us into early January and somehow it has to be in some form or fashion attached to the budget bill to keep the government from shutting down again on January 15th, we're still optimistic we can get it done.
Well, I want to mention right now that we welcome your phone calls and emails. If the farm bill affects your livelihood directly, we especially want to hear from you. Has the delay in approving a new farm bill worried you, and how and why? Give us a call or an email. Tell us about it. Our toll-free number at Focus is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Jonathan, I was wondering, because we just Mary Kay just brought up the question of dairy prices possibly going up. As a matter of fact, NPR's Morning Edition a couple of days ago did a story on that, but I noticed one thing was missing on the story of this threatened rise in dairy prices was exactly when it would take place. Really, the first question is, why would dairy prices go up without a farm bill?
Yeah, and first off, Mary Kay, it's good to hear from you again. I hope you're holding up well out there. Certainly, Mary Kay makes a great point, which is it's not necessarily the case that January 1, you know, all kinds of problems show up. What we have is for the commodity programs in the Farm Bill, in Title I of the Farm Bill, there's a what's called a reversion to permanent law. And permanent law was the 1949 Act where we had these parity pricing issues where we were trying to boost prices through purchases of commodities and whatnot. And they're obviously very outdated. If they're from 1949, they don't exactly apply to where the markets are today. What those do is they operate on a crop year basis. So for dairy, the crop year actually technically begins January 1st. And so your new crop year, if there's not an extension or something else to suspend that permanent law for the next crop year, it technically could come into play January 1st. The reality is, I think part of what Mary Kay is getting to is that's not an automatic switch that just turns on January 1. The U.S. Department of Agriculture would actually have to undertake an entire process to write the regulations and implement a program. And there's a lot of questions about how you can do that. What kind of data do they have to be able to make a 1949 Act program work in 2013? And how long would that take? So there, I think she's right. I think there's some flex room. And I think some of that flexibility, if you will, after the first of the year is going to be determined by how close the principles are or how close it appears the Farm Bill is to succeeding.
But the question for me still is, what is it that the federal government would do that could potentially do in a worst case scenario at some point that would cause milk prices to shoot up?
Yeah, I think the simplest way to describe that is they'd be purchasing dairy products at a high price level, which was the original concept of how you supported that price by having the federal government go out and buy dairy products, milk, at a pretty high level that would then trigger or sort of impact the market. So as big of a purchaser as the federal government would be, it could, you know, you could begin to see the market react to it. But I think that's the simplest way to understand is they'd be out buying.
They'll be out buying. They'd be about buying at high prices.
Right.
Dairy farmers would be foolish to refuse. Maybe they couldn't refuse. And also the rest of the market would also start rising to that level.
I think that's – sorry, go ahead, Mary.
You know, I think it's important to understand, too, though, that nobody ever really expects the 1949 Act to go into effect. And that's the case every time we write a farm bill. Every 5 years, we put a little blip in there that says if you don't get the farm bill done, we'll revert to the 1949 Act. It's not meant to ever go into effect. I don't think it's ever really come close to going into effect. But the fact is it's meant as a sledgehammer to make sure that Congress does come back and does pass a bill and reviews agricultural policy, food policy, the whole gamut in the Farm Bill every 5 years.
Of course, sequestration was never meant to go into effect, and yet the federal government is operating under it today. But do both of you feel pretty comfortable, and especially looking after the progress announced by the four big Ag Committee negotiators, essentially the two chairs and the ranking members of the House and Senate Ag Committees, that progress was being made? Do you feel that progress is being made that will be welcomed and recognized on the general floor of the House and Senate so those two chambers can come together on a farm bill?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, welcomed is an interesting term, but I think there has been real progress made. You know, a conference committee is about negotiations. It's about everybody giving a little bit. Nobody gets everything they want, and then you have a pretty good product. And they have really struggled. I think it's not a secret that food stamps, SNAP program, has been the biggest hurdle. There's certainly a large dollar difference between a $4 billion cut in food stamps over the next 10 years that the Senate passed and a $40 billion one that the House passed. But even more important than the number, I think, is the philosophical viewpoints behind that. And this will be a generality, but, you know, in general, you have a good number of Tea Party Republicans, particularly in the House, who feel very strongly that we should be cutting way more than $40 billion out of food stamps. And again, in general, you have some liberal Democrats who feel like we can't cut a nickel. And so when you look at those philosophies and you look at, you know, should we be forcing people to work? What about the heat and eat loophole? All those kinds of things. People have pretty steadfast opinions. And the conferees, therefore, have had to work really hard at trying to come up with something in the middle that can indeed pass both the House and the Senate and be signed by the president. But it certainly is sounding in the last couple of days like there's been some good give and take, not only on that issue, but on many issues. And then, indeed, yeah, we're going to get a farm bill in the next 30 days or so.
I want to get into more details on the whole SNAP, food stamp question a little bit later. Let me ask the big picture question that I think everybody asks every time they reintroduce the farm bill to the general public. Mary Kay, maybe you can take a stab at it here. In a nutshell, what does the farm bill cover?
You know, the farm bill probably affects virtually every American because it covers not only farm policy type things that provide a safety net for our farmers and ranchers, but it covers things like conservation programs, rural development programs, like getting broadband out to the rural areas because they're so far behind those of us who happen to live in the city, you know, improving hospitals, those kind of things. There are credit programs, things for specialty crops. There's assistance, for example. We all heard about the huge and terrible snowstorm they had out in western South Dakota, western Nebraska, where thousands of head of cattle were lost. It provides some assistance for those guys to get back up on their feet. But then again, you move over, and again, about 80% of the cost of this bill is indeed nutrition assistance. So it's help for the Women, Infant, and Children's Program, the pregnant women, the food stamp. So many, many Americans are affected by this bill.
Jonathan, how is the talk, the congressional debate and discussion and negotiation surrounding this farm bill different from the last time it came up for reauthorization in 2008?
Well, I think without a doubt this one has struggled mightily, and it's taken quite a long time to get through. Of course, I'd always point out that the last farm bill had a few challenges of its own, including being vetoed by the president, and Congress had to override that veto.
That was vetoed by President George W. Bush.
That's correct.
Okay.
But I think, Mary Kay, I think, certainly has probably some good perspective on this as well. But I think if you had to boil down probably the single biggest reason this one has struggled is that we're in this budget-cutting environment that, you know, the 2008 Farm Bill actually added spending. It added some new programs like the Average Crop Revenue Election Program and the Supplemental Disaster Programs, and something Mary Kay mentioned with the snowstorms and the assistance to livestock producers. It added money to SNAP, I believe. This time around, this whole process has been consumed by cutting the amount of spending, cutting down programs, either eliminating programs, consolidating programs, or just trimming back how the programs operate to eliminate some spending or reduce spending. And that's a very different aspect that really creates a struggle for a lot of individuals, because now you're getting into some of these very tough and difficult political matters, such as what we're seeing with SNAP, I think is a great example of how that further complicates or really complicates the ability to negotiate this and get it through.
Mary Kay, I'm wondering just from your standpoint, do things look different? Does Congress look different now than in 2008 or even maybe the Farm Bill previous to that?
Well, it does. Now, I think Jonathan has hit the nail on the head on, you know, the biggest problem is everybody's having to give up money. It's a lot easier to write a farm bill when you got more money to spend than less. But it, absolutely, and things have certainly changed, I think, every 10 years, especially when we do a new census. We get fewer and fewer people in Congress who represent rural regions. And therefore, when they look at the 20% of the farm bill that is mostly about farmers and ranchers, they have less desire to want to be supportive of that. Their focus is oftentimes in other places. Certainly when you look at the last 30 years, you know, you used to be able to go to almost any member of Congress and find out that they were from a farm or they had an uncle from a farm and they had spent a couple of weeks in the summer out there baling hay ever since they were a kid, and they understood what a farm was and they had an appreciation for it. And they actually knew farmers and ranchers, and that we get further and further away from that every generation. So we spend a tremendous amount of time just trying to educate urban and suburban members and staffers about agriculture and about the fact that, you know, milk doesn't come from the grocery store.
And you're making me think of there's something that I picked up that our producer picked up for me, I should say, and that's a briefing from the Heritage Foundation that they put out this week concerning the Farm Bill. And I just gathered that there was just a strong sense of skepticism towards this bill as far as the Heritage Foundation was concerned. And a lot of it was towards the SNAP program, but not all of it. I think they also had a lot of questions about farm subsidies and how they should be handled. Is that something that is different, or is it stronger at a different level as far as skepticism about the Farm Bill from the conservative side of Congress?
Oh, the Heritage Foundation has been involved in at least the last couple of farm bills, but yes, I think they're more involved in this one. There are other groups, our Street Partnership, Taxpayers Union, et cetera, that have been involved, but far more this time. And I think, without a doubt, the Heritage Foundation has been leading the charge on saying, we'd like to split up the nutrition title from the farm title. And they're very vocal about the reason for wanting to do that is that they haven't been as successful in cutting programs on both sides as they would like to do, like to be. And if they could split them in half, they think they could have more success. So the Heritage Foundation has certainly picked up, especially on the increasing number of Tea Party Republicans, and sort of tried to hammer home, we have to reform, reform, reform. I mean, I don't think they could find a program in the federal government that they don't want to reform. So it's no surprise that this is where they are in agriculture, but in answer to your question, absolutely. They have been far more diligent and far more involved in this farm bill than previous bills.
When it comes to the SNAP program now and what we used to call food stamps, as you mentioned, I think the House actually went ahead and at one point passed a separate SNAP program bill independent of the farm bill. And from what I'm told, that's probably not how everything is going to go ahead, and it's going to be folded back into the farm bill because the Senate, that's the only way the Senate will pass it. But there's still the question of the cuts that the House was seeking in comparison to the Senate. And Jonathan, you worked on some versions of this bill. What is the fight center on? What sort of things are being proposed for cuts?
Well, and that's a great question, and I think Mary Kay touched on some of this earlier. There are two big pieces. What everybody focuses on first and foremost are the level of cuts or the amount of money that's cut out of the program. The Senate's at about $4 billion over 10 years. The House is at about $40 billion over 10 years. So certainly a big gap between the amount of spending they are cutting out of the bill. And so, definitely that level of difference is hard to bridge in a negotiation. But I think, as Mary Kay mentioned, it's actually more than the dollars that are at issue. It's how you get to those dollars in reductions. And both programs utilize a change in what's been termed as a loophole in how the SNAP benefits get calculated. So the individual's benefits, there's a way that you can calculate those that gets kind of complex. But the best way I've ever heard it explained is sort of you get – when you have taxes, you have tax deductions based on certain expenditures for SNAP. You kind of have the same thing, and one of those involves your utilities and heating expenses. And there's heating assistance for low-income households, and the way those two work together can allow you to get that deduction while receiving heating assistance. Some states have been using that in a way that arguably goes against congressional intent by issuing everybody that's possible. Issuing them $1, a nominal amount of money for the heating assistance, and then that actually increases the amount of SNAP they can get. These are still households.
There was a phrase for that. I don't know.
Heat and eat.
Heat and eat. That's right.
Yeah. So these are still households that are eligible for SNAP, would be eligible no matter what, and it just increases the potential benefit they get. This is particularly used in the Northeast where heating costs are very expensive and living expenses are very high. So that's both sides have looked at that and have closed that loophole in different ways or made some modifications to it. What you really get into the issue is when the House went beyond the LIHEAP, the heat and eat provisions, and they went into eligibility matters. And what that does, without getting into the specifics, the political aspect of that is when you go into that, you're actually removing people or preventing removing people from program assistance or preventing them from getting it.
So it's not just a matter of how much benefits
exactly.
they get. It's whether they get them or not.
Right. People that are currently eligible or otherwise would be eligible then are prevented, kicked off or prevented. And CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has estimated, you know, millions, depending on which provision it is, millions of individuals that could be impacted by that. And just when you think politically, those are voters, those are constituents, and those are very hard, real-world issues that members of Congress have to deal with back home, particularly in some of the regions and districts where the economy has not recovered as well, where the recession continues to limit the amount of jobs that are available. And this is assistance to help you eat. And at the end of the day, that's the whole point of SNAP, is to help put food on the table. And so when you start removing those people or changing that eligibility, you really get into a tough political situation for members that they have people now that will struggle even more to be able to eat. And I think that real-world implication just complicates how you deal with the program.
Well, if there's a disagreement in terms of how you make the reductions, does that make it harder for a compromise to happen? Because it sounds like if one side's talking about apples and the other side's talking about oranges, it's hard to meet halfway across the table.
Yes, I think it makes it much more difficult to find a simple middle ground or a split the difference kind of situation, because you're talking about eligibility, and that in and of itself is it's almost an on or off switch. There's not kind of a middle ground in that. Now, you know, hopefully they continue to work and continue to try to find ways, and certainly some of the comments from a few members of the House this morning in the press indicate some reason for cautious optimism about finding some ways forward. But at the end of the day, it certainly complicates the ability to reach a compromise.
Well, I want to go back to some of the other aspects of the Farm Bill before we lose Mary Kay, because her time is limited with us. I understand there's also a dispute that refers back to what you might call the main parts of the farm bills that affect commodities and what different commodities would get under this bill. I had been, if you could explain this to me, Mary Kay, I've been reading about a dispute between base or planted acreage. Am I getting the jargon right?
You are, but saying it's probably easier than explaining it. Many programs since 1996 have been paid depending on what acres you had in production in, say, the 1980s. And it was put into place that way so that if Congress did not set the right prices, for example, they set target prices where you get paid if the price of the commodity falls below whatever the congressionally set level is, if they happen to misjudge and set it too high, you weren't going to be paid, you weren't going to be distorting the market and having farmers taking their signal from the government on what was to plant just because a certain price support was too high, but instead you were taking that signal from the marketplace. In general, the Senate side has been very supportive of continuing that base acre concept. The downside of that is that it's difficult to explain what a base acre is and why, especially to an urban member of Congress, would you use something that is that outdated. But one of the other really positive things about base acres is that under the World Trade Organization, there are certain things that are called trade distorting that could have more impact on distorting trade between the U.S. and elsewhere. It's viewed as less trade distorting than is planted acre, so it's better for us as we, you know, continue to keep our fingers crossed that something will happen in Bali and we will actually move the World Trade Organization negotiations forward. So there are pros and cons to whether you base the payment based on an old historic base acre or on a planted acre basis.
I had been reading that this had actually led to some, well, maybe it's not, maybe it's a friction that exists anyway, but a more public friction between some different commodities. Now, here in Illinois, we grow lots of corn and soybeans, and I understand they have one side of this. but maybe there are some other commodities which we're looking at a different side of this. Has there been friction over this issue between different parts of farming?
I think so. I think you would indeed find corn and soybean production. Now, some soybean production especially occurs down in the southeast, being more supportive of staying with the base acres, feeling like it is more compliant and it is less market distorting, and people more like rice and peanut producers feeling like planted acres was more the way to go. So that has been a point of contention in the commodity title, yes.
Okay, and I'm reading in the website political.com reporting on yesterday's talks by the Farm Bill negotiators that the House has moved off its position that all commodity subsidies be a function of a farmer's planted acres. Is that what you're getting as well, that that there seems to be some movement in negotiations on this?
Well, that's certainly the rumor on the street today, but I can't tell you that I have seen anything in writing to confirm that, nor have I had that confirmed verbally by anybody who was in the room. So, you know, I tend to believe that that's a correct statement, but I've lived in Washington long enough to know that sometimes a bad rumor gets started and it just keeps snowballing, too. So,
is that the sort of thing that's going to be a big concern to people when any sort of farm bill gets to the House floor? People outside the Agriculture Committee, will they essentially accept that part of the package, whatever it is? Or will that be a potential red flag for somebody on one side or the other, the way, say, any settlement on SNAP benefits may be?
Oh, no, I think the SNAP benefit issue is 10 or 20 times more important than planted or base acres to the vast majority of members of the House and Senate.
Okay, but for people in your organization, I take it the commodity subsidies are very important.
Well, they are. And, you know, I think, generally speaking, I get on a program like this and somebody calls in and you get a lot of pushback about why are we giving farmers subsidies? You know, I work and I don't get a subsidy. And so I think it's important as we're thinking about the context of this farm bill to reflect on the fact that, you know, I don't just compete on my farming operation with the guy down the road or the guy the next county over. I compete on a worldwide basis in agriculture. And when you look at the way that developed countries around the world support their farmers and ranchers, we are way below average. We're at about 9% of every dollar that goes in a farmer's pocket comes from some form or another of government payments. But on average, we're in the 20s and 30s. And if we look at some of our trade competitors like Japan, theirs is up around 60 cents of every dollar. So we feel like in agriculture, we need to continue to make sure that our commodity programs are supporting farmers and ranchers. And we are very supportive of moving the World Trade Organization negotiations along and reducing those support levels around the world. But certainly we don't feel like we should unilaterally disarm here at home and make our farmers compete not only against farmers elsewhere, but farmers and their government elsewhere.
Okay. And before I let you go, maybe I could just ask, if you want to make a prediction as to how this farm bill, assuming that we're going to have a farm bill sometime in the beginning of 2014, how farmers will be doing by it? Do you expect, it sounds like you're, the battle is over, you know, an overall smaller pie. Is this going to be a tougher year for farmers because of that?
Well, I do think we're going to get it done. I wasn't also that sure when Jonathan Coppice left us and fled to Illinois because he has been a big part of these negotiations for a long time. But I think we will get it done by the middle of January. I think that we can build a farm bill with an adequate safety net. You know, much of the safety net that will be built will put even more emphasis on the crop insurance program, which in a vast majority of the U.S. has been a very popular program. So I think we can have a program with an adequate safety net for farmers and ranchers.
Well, Mary Kay Thatcher, I know your time is limited with us. This has got to be a busy time for you as this thing continues to be discussed. But I wanted to thank you very much for coming on Focus today.
You bet. Thank you.
Thank you. Mary Kay Thatcher of the American Farm Bureau Federation. And also with us today is Professor Jonathan Coppice of the University of Illinois with agriculture and consumer education, formerly spending a lot of time out in on Capitol Hill with, I guess, the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, Debbie Stabenow, and working on the farm bill until recently.
That's correct.
Well, we will be continuing our efforts to dissect and understand the Farm Bill here on Focus after a short break. This is Focus on WYLL. We are back on Focus here on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're continuing our discussion of the Farm Bill debate with the University of Illinois Agricultural and Consumer Economics Professor. Consumer Economics, did I say that? Consumer Education?
Consumer Economics, yes.
Okay. Anyway, Professor Jonathan Kappas, formerly of working for Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow, and which also means that you were formerly working on the Farm Bill.
That's correct. I spent the better part of the last 3 years writing, helping the chairwoman write the Farm Bill and working on a whole host of the provisions that are in it, but specifically a lot of work on the commodity supports, crop insurance, conservation, and a few of the other titles. So it's been a tough road, and it's there's reason for cautious optimism. I'm kind of glad to see some of the comments you saw in the press this morning that it sounds like they're making progress. I'd love to see this bill get completed, get across the finish line, and have a 5-year bill in place for all of agriculture. And you know, I think everybody involved with it is ready for it to get over with, and they can move on and work on some other items. But it's been a long slog.
Well, the negotiators apparently were saying from the news coverage that I saw yesterday, after yesterday's meeting, that they were optimistic, but they still were not promising any sort of bill until after January 1st, which is when at least the dairy price supports would technically expire. We were wondering, do you think if that's going to be the case, is Congress going to put together some sort of temporary short-term stopgap extension, say just for their winter recess, if they're not going to pass something now?
It's a good question. I think some of that's going to depend on how much more progress is made between now and frankly, I think next Friday is kind of the last date that both the Senate and the House are in session together. So I think if they make real progress and you sort of see it kind of get to that momentum point where it's ready to go, it's ready to get on the floor, and they've done the whip counting and they've got a sense of the ability to pass the bill, then you probably don't need the extension because, as we mentioned earlier, the dairy issue, while it is the potential of an issue, isn't necessarily on – you're not going to wake up on New Year's Day and have milk prices going – go down to the store and it's at $7 or $8. So there, I think there's some flexibility in there to allow for them to work it out. You know, there's quite a bit of work to be done even once a final agreement is reached. And I think that's kind of what we're looking at now. You've got a lot of work in how the legislative language is shaped and, frankly, on how the Congressional Budget Office estimates what these deals or agreements are going to cost. And so that's going to take some time just working through those pieces once you have a final deal, if in fact they're getting closer, as it indicates in the press.
Well, if you have questions about the Farm Bill, perhaps the Farm Bill affects you directly, call us with your thoughts and questions. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. A larger picture question, maybe more on the philosophical underpinnings of how the Farm Bill works and why, in terms of price supports, from Brian, who emailed us, writing that maybe it's because I wasn't raised in central Illinois, but it's hard to understand why the Farm Bill has so many kickbacks for corn, soy, and dairy when fruit and vegetable farmers are left out to freeze. Kickbacks are Brian's words, and I'm sure supporters of the Farm Bill don't use that word when they're talking about farm subsidies, but I understand that fruits and vegetables do not receive the sort of subsidies that, say, corn and soybeans and dairy do.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of folks would have some disagreement with the term kickback. But to the extent that you're talking about the support programs and the federal support to farmers, most of it now is income support for farmers and crop insurance, so production support and assistance and risk management assistance. There is a difference. You have the bulk commodities, the corn, the soybeans, the cotton, rice, wheat. Those big bulk commodities are what in the Farm Bill are the ones that are in the programs where the farmers receive direct financial assistance from the government. There is a whole title of the Farm Bill that is dedicated to fruit and vegetable production. It's Title 10 of the bill, and it deals with assisting a host of different aspects of fruit and vegetable farming, everything from helping fund pest and disease research and pest and disease response issues, which is a unique concern for fruits and vegetables, as well as helping with state efforts from everything from farmers markets to marketing and promotion and things like that. So there is assistance for the fruit and vegetable growers.
But not the same sort or the same scope of assistance.
That's correct. It is by no means anywhere close to the same amount of money or the same kind. It is not a direct financial assistance to farmers of those crops. The other area that I'd point out that is important is crop insurance. And crop insurance, Mary Kay mentioned this earlier, pretty much anybody you talk to, whether you're in central Illinois or California or Michigan, crop insurance was a big, big issue. And it's become the predominant safety net for farmers. And one of the things the Farm Bill did, particularly in the Senate, was work to expand crop insurance coverage, crop insurance policies for fruit and vegetable farmers so that they could have the same kind of risk management tools or similar risk management tools to what, say, corn and soybean farmers in Illinois have. And that is a big part of helping out. But certainly the Title I, the commodity subsidies, are very different.
Why is that emphasis given on the commodity subsidies over fruit and vegetables?
You know, that's a great question, and you kind of have to go back. You probably have to go back to the very beginnings, 80 years ago, when Congress and the Roosevelt administration first pushed to provide assistance to farmers during the Great Depression, as to, you know, how they picked and chose between different crops and different farmers and how that's evolved over time. You know, I don't think I can give you a great answer today. I think a lot of it, Mary Kay mentioned some of the market issues, that bulk commodities are somewhat different in market and foreign competition. And so I think it's sort of grown out of some of that.
Is there a factor because these are commodity crops, these are crops which can be more easily stored, that might be seen as a more basic staple of food, that in a situation when there was a danger of real shortages coming up, that maybe a decision was made by federal officials that these were the crops that people needed to give first attention to in order to prevent genuine panic, maybe even ideas of things like food riots or something like that?
I mean, certainly a commodity like wheat is a great example. It's a very, very much a staple commodity. And we saw it in recent years, as recently as, I think, 2008, where you had loss of wheat production around the world. And it did trigger some pretty tough moments in parts of the world where, you know, some countries had cut off exports, some countries had... You saw lines of individuals trying to get food and trying to get bread. And so those staple commodities, yes, there is certainly a big argument that you want to ensure that production. You want to make sure that the nation can continue to produce enough, in the case of the United States, produce enough not only for us to eat, but we provide quite a bit of the world's supply of these staple commodities. And I think it goes to some of the struggles they've had historically, both with markets and with production issues, and how the programs then evolved particularly out of the Great Depression and out of the farm crisis of that era, and then again in the 80s, where you have that large bulk commodity production and just some of the different aspects that go with that because they're storable, because you're competing worldwide for many of them. And again, it goes back to exactly what you said, which is we do this, fundamentally do this to make sure that as a nation we can produce the commodities and the fruits and vegetables, but particularly the commodities and everything we need to continue to be able to provide food.
You were working up in Washington as late as earlier this year. You've been with the U of I since beginning of the fall semester. I'm wondering, when you look at the Congress today and the more divided Congress, there is right now and the reduced clout of agriculture that, Mary Kay Thatcher talked about. Do you see this same understanding and appreciation of this sort of system of played out in the Farm Bill? Does it have the same sort of backing in Congress that it did, say, maybe 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, that's a great question, and at the risk of giving a shameless plug for some work I'm doing right now, myself and another fellow professor in the department, Todd Keithy, and I will have a Farm Doc Daily post today that begins to try to explore this question as to what has happened in this Farm Bill cycle and this Farm Bill effort that is different from the past. And the first look we did was compared to 1996, which was a very difficult Farm Bill undertaking as well, in some similar situations where you had a lot of partisan fighting between Congress and the White House and a series of issues. We were looking at cutting spending and whatnot. So we're trying to answer some of that. And one of the first things you notice is kind of, you know, how the different regions of the country, how they line up with their party affiliation and how that has changed over time. And, you know, it raises questions about whether or not those sort of trends have made it more difficult. But again, a lot of it comes back to the big challenges we have in writing this kind of legislation in a difficult budgetary environment. And, you know, when you're making changes to programs or eliminating programs that people use and depend upon in some cases, it makes it tough politically. And I think America made the point. As a nation, we're not a kind of rural-based nation as we were in, say, the 30s. And we certainly, you know, the bulk of the districts in Congress are urban or suburban. And many people have not had that continuing contact with farming and agriculture to understand, frankly, the risks that are involved in trying to produce a commodity that goes into the food you eat. And I think she mentioned an education process. That was a big part of it, and that continues to be a big part of trying to educate members and groups and constituents on what these programs do and why and the importance of farming and agriculture to their everyday life. I mean, most of us don't farm, but all of us eat, and I think that's always kind of the starting point for the conversation.
That Farm Doc Daily that you talked about, of course, is online at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu, and you can find a link to it at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Look up the installment for today's program, and you'll find the link right there. Again, that's will.illinois.edu/focus. Still time to take your questions and comments about the Farm Bill for U of I Agricultural and Consumer Ag Professor Jonathan Kappes. Call us at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Carol from Urbana is asking if biofuels play into the Farm Bill in any particular way. Do crops grown and subsidized for biofuel, are they part of is that issue part of the Farm Bill?
Part of it is, yes. Carol may be referring to the renewable fuel standard, which is not a part of the Farm Bill. That's the mandate that we blend biofuels into our gasoline supply. However, there is an entire title of the Farm Bill in both the House and the Senate that's been there since 2002, we've had it for about 10 years now, that provides assistance for the production of biofuels and for renewable energy in general. You know, a couple examples. The last Farm Bill in 2008 created a program called the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, and it was designed specifically to help farmers with transitioning into biomass crops, things like miscanthus and switchgrass. There's a lot of work being done on miscanthus here at the university. And it was a program to help farmers offset some of the cost to switch to a new crop, some of the risk of a new crop. So you have programs like that. There were loans and loan guarantee programs for renewable energy facilities and things like that. So biofuels do play into it. But if you're asking specifically about the renewable fuel standard, that's not a part of the Farm Bill.
Okay. To the degree that they do play in, is that a bone of contention in these latest negotiations?
I don't think it's necessarily a bone of contention. I think it impacts the negotiations in sort of some ways that kind of make some difficult conversations in agriculture. And we've seen it over the years between, a few years back, you had this food versus fuel debate. You had some issues in the livestock industry that are concerned about the amount of corn that goes into biofuel production. So I think that factors into the discussion, that factors into probably more than anything, the perspective that different members bring to the negotiations. Certainly the prices that have been as strong as they have been in recent years, a lot of that, people look at the RFS, they look at planning decisions that farmers have had, and you get a series of questions and concerns. So I think it impacts the people's views and that part of the debate, but it doesn't actually, it's not one of those things that they're negotiating over or have a broad disagreement about that they have to resolve for the farm bill itself.
Let's go ahead and take a caller, and I want to say hello to Daryl in Bloomington on line 4. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. I'm a typical corn soybean farmer, Central Illinois. And I want to raise a question about crop insurance. The revenue insurance that we have is a great risk management innovation. Other countries are trying to copy it. Don't want to do a thing to diminish that. But on a certain level, I think it promotes larger, narrow margin operations. And there's proposals that there be a cap put on the crop insurance premium subsidies, and I think that's a common sense idea that everybody has access to crop insurance premium subsidies up to a certain level, and then above that you can still buy crop insurance, but you pay the full load. It seems to me that would be a good reform in our crop insurance program.
Can you talk a little more about that, Jonathan?
Sure. I think you hit on a great point, or a point that's been a matter of discussion. And there's been various proposals on sort of along the lines you've talked about, whether you'd actually limit. And just for folks that aren't as familiar with the crop insurance program, quickly on a background situation, what it is the farmer purchases crop insurance, just like you would purchase insurance for your car or health insurance. And, the farmer pays a premium, but a portion of that premium is offset by the federal government. It's not actually a subsidy to the farmer. It's sort of a reduction in the overall premium cost, and then that money goes into the larger fund, the risk pool, if you will, that helps pay out when there are losses. But it's not a direct subsidy. So there's been some proposals whether you would cap the amount of premium subsidy a farmer could get. Similar in the commodity support programs, we have limits. We have payment limits on the amount any one farmer can receive from a program. There was also an amendment that passed in the Senate both in 2012 and this past year that would reduce the percentage of premium assistance for those farmers that have an adjusted gross income above $750,000. So there's been a couple proposals that have come through. That amendment was agreed to by the Senate both last year and this year, so it's a part of this negotiation. Just to be candid, there's some real resistance to that throughout the industry, throughout farming. And I think one of the concerns that people have is what does it do? Certainly understanding the budget and reform issues, but because it's an insurance product, what we don't know is how that changes how insurance will operate and will work for all farmers. If all of a sudden it changes purchase behavior, it causes big farmers that buy large policies and insure a large amount of acreage, if they change how they buy insurance, does that up the cost for everybody else? Because keeping in mind that the insurance program works when you've got a lot of farmers and a lot of acreage in and you're able to spread that risk of indemnities, you were able to spread it across large areas and different risks scenarios. So it's definitely come up. It's definitely been a part of the argument or discussion and debate. There's still some pretty big unknowns about what the consequences might be.
And Daryl, I hope that helps.
One more question. Is that actually part of the farm bill? Because people have said if the farm bill doesn't pass, that crop insurance is something separate, and it goes on anyway. Is that true?
That is true. Crop insurance is a permanent statute. It does not have a sunset date, what we call a sunset date. The farm bill commodity titles programs, for example, direct payments and all that, have a five-year sunset date. And so, but crop insurance is permanent. It's been there since 1938. It continues, but the Farm Bill does make changes periodically to that crop insurance statute, and that's what we're talking about. So there's a title of this Farm Bill that would make changes in the permanent crop insurance statute, but if a Farm Bill doesn't pass, the crop insurance program continues as it is today.
Okay. Darrell, thank you for the call. I just wanted to clarify from my own curiosity. We're talking about revenue insurance. Are we talking about insurance that's based on how well the crop harvest is, or based on, you know, how much of a price the farmer can get for it?
Well, revenue is a function of both. It's a function of the yields and the prices. So, for example, for corn, you've got a production history that you use that determines how you set the guarantee for your yields, and there are yield-based policies. But there's also been a huge move towards the revenue-based policies, which means coming up in the spring for corn, the risk management agency looks at the futures prices for corn in the fall and sets a estimated price. Price times yield gives you this revenue guarantee that you then insure against. So should, much in the same way, if a drought wipes out your corn crop in the summer, you will get an indemnity most likely from the insurance program. But because it's revenue, you know, the price is factored into it. So you may lose some yield, but the price goes up, so you don't have a loss in revenue. The other way around, you may have a good yield and low price, and you still might not have a revenue loss. So it's just a different way of calculating the coverage and how and what it covers, but it covers both price and yield.
And that's where we're going to stop it right now. Farm Bill is a big subject, and I just hope we've been able to shed a little more light on it. It'll certainly be in the news in the next few weeks. My thanks to you, Jonathan Kappas of the University of Illinois, for being on the program today, along with Mary Kay Thatcher of the American Farm Bureau Federation. This is Focus on WYLL.